Welcome to the penultimate episode of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute. Right now we're at Minute 131, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today for this special Saturday edition is my good friend Jason Sturczyk of Agent Palmer. Welcome to the show, Jason. It's been 2 seasons since I've seen you, so welcome back.
Yeah, but I'm excited to get the penultimate again.
That's right. You're apparently a penultimate person.
It's a very fun place to be, right? Because like everything has really basically happened, and with the exception of you taking on Marvel movies, where there will be an after credits, like I get to discuss the whole thing. This is kind of cool.
Correct. No, again, I don't think I'm going to be doing Marvel movies. There are other people who do them. I like to keep things in my own niche. You know, up until now, we've only been doing movies from the 80s. So, and we're going to continue with that. We did one movie in the 60s. Sorry. So we did 1963. Yeah, 63. I mean, then we jumped to 2 movies in the 80s. And, you know, next season, which people don't know yet, they'll find out tomorrow what my season 4 is. But just a little hint that I've already given once before. You know, last season we did Planes, Trains, Automobiles, which was a movie from 1987. This season we did Die Hard, 1988. Next season is a movie from 1989. So start guessing. You can send me, you know, send me by Twitter, by Facebook, whatever, you know, your guesses. You know, obviously not anyone who's already been invited to be a guest, because that's just cheating. But yeah. Anyone who doesn't know, you know, send out your guesses. And we'll see if anyone even comes close to figuring out what 1989 movie we were doing. And, you know, the irony is season 5, which potentially at this point will be Die Hard 2, is 1990. So I think I'm getting myself into a little bit of a rut here, because I'm going to have to look for movies in 1991 to do for season 6. But, you know, we're a year from that. So
yeah, we got getting time. Ahead of the game.
Yeah. Someone asked me if I'm going to do JFK, and I was like, I don't think so. I love JFK. It's a great movie, but it's not one that I could do a podcast on, because, you know, it would just take – each episode would be like 5 hours long just talking about all the conspiracy theories that go on there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah. You know, in the movie itself, it's like a 4-hour movie, I think the director's cut, and it still doesn't feel like a complete movie. There's so much still missing. But whatever. We're not talking about JFK. We're here actually to talk about Die Hard. You know, or at least credits of Die Hard. You know, we started the credits earlier this week. We got credits again today. Today is all credits episode, you know, which Jason and I are going to just go through. I mean, we're not going to talk about all the credits. Don't worry. You know, you're not here to listen to us say, okay, and the person who did the makeup is this, and the person who did that. No, we're going to pick. We have a few that we're going to pick and choose that we're going to talk about, you know, some of the people, some of the professions, and we'll get into. I got some fun stuff lined up. So hopefully Jason does too, you know, but yeah, even if you don't, we have what to talk about. So we'll be able to figure that out.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm not concerned. I think you and I are both, you know, experienced enough podcasters to know how to talk about, you know, a minute that has just words on the screen.
Yeah, so. And as a person who has, before I got into podcasting, spent nothing but time putting words on screens, as a blogger, let's go.
Right. All right, great. So minute 131 begins with the second assistant to John McTiernan and ends with a Stevie Wonder song credit.
Yes.
So yesterday we ended the episode with the first assistant to John McTiernan, who was his ex-wife. We talked about that a little bit yesterday, Carol Land, who is also the mother of the child actor who plays John Jr. You know, but from what I learned, or what I tried to find out, is he's not John McTiernan's son. So I'm very confused about all the things, but who knows? You know, there's certain things, even IMDb can't give you everything. You know, I guess there's some privacy out there.
That's fair. It's so weird that McTiernan also got 2 assistants. As Bruce Willis getting 2 assistants on this particular flick, he's carrying the movie. It makes sense. McTiernan having 2 assistants makes absolutely no sense to me.
Well, Again, we don't, you know, one of the things that you never know is what is the job of these assistants? You know, like
That's true.
are these secretaries? You know, are these runners? Like what is, I've never understood really what an assistant to the director, an assistant to the producer. You know, you have two producers that are listed here that we talked about, one yesterday and one we'll talk about today. You know, if Joel Silver had, sorry, there were two yesterday. There was Lawrence Gordon and Joel Silver. Both of them have two assistants, which is also strange that, you know, these two assistants, I'm assuming, aren't working solely on this movie. They're working on any other productions that the two of them are dealing with. And then you have today another producer, Charles Gordon, who only has one assistant. So
Yeah.
I you know, it's all arbitrary. Again, you know, is an assistant a secretary? I don't know. You know.
I mean it as a person who recently got his name on IMDb for the first time in an official capacity, it
Hey, wait a
could
second.
be.
I put you on there a while ago. You're saying that's not official?
Well, this is now for a movie. I am
Did you
I'm an
use the same
expense.
link that you listed from my show, or did you
I
create a new
don't
one?
know. I need to. I still haven't spent the time to link my stuff. But I am an executive producer, assistant editor. Like there were two of us that made this movie, so really, like we split a lot of titles and stuff. But I will say, like, when you start trying to make credits, which is something we had to do, it was it's weird because even though there were just the two of us, we all did a lot of things, obviously. And
Right.
obviously, as a two-man crew, it takes a lot longer to build a movie together. But it was just, having your name up there is pretty cool. And I got to see the like we did an official screening, and eventually the movie will come out to the masses. But it was just seeing your name up there in lights. I could be the assistant to the assistant. I think I'd be very excited about it.
Well, I mean, I just went into IMDb, and it's a little strange then because it just says Jason Sturczyk, you know, and it only shows this podcast, you know, the two episodes that you were on, and it doesn't have like a one after it or a two that there's, you know, there's more than one of
Yeah,
them.
I gotta figure out how to link that stuff to the movie. Yeah, I helped make a movie.
Well, that isn't that what we're doing here? We're helping to make a movie 34 years after it came out.
That's true. That's true.
Know, so why not? Right. So again, I don't know why McTiernan needs two assistants. Maybe one of them is his actual lawyer, you know, because maybe he was wiretapping people at the time also. I don't know. You know, his second assistant is named Pamela Alessandrelli. Okay. And this was actually her very first movie credit. And she has a total of 18 movie credits on IMDb. And you know, she's been in some other McTiernan films. So she apparently stayed his assistant for a little bit at least.
Hey, consistency is a good thing to have.
Yeah, especially, I mean, obviously if you want to have an assistant who can, you know, who knows what they're doing and knows, and what's more importantly, knows you.
Yes.
You know,
Yes.
that
Well, I think we'd all want that.
okay, that's true, but apparently they have that here.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Do I want an assistant who knows? I don't know. I don't know. In my day job, I prefer to actually, you know, do things on my own as opposed to having an assistant do them for me because, you know, sometimes it's just easier to do things on your own instead of having to explain to someone else how to do them.
I guess that's the yeah. Although in this instance, I expect that, they're taking care of the acting and the assistant's taking care of everything else, which is
Probably. Right. Yeah.
exactly what you want them to do. So
Correct.
we can focus on podcasting and they can do the other stuff.
Right. Okay. That's fair. Yeah. She actually a year later became an assistant to Joel Silver, you know, when for in Lethal Weapon 2. So I don't know. I guess she, you know, she worked in, you know, in Fox, and they just moved her around between the director and you know, the producer to be the assistant to help them deal with what they needed to deal with.
Yeah, just let's keep you as an assistant to cop action genres, and you can go from Die Hard to Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
And you'll never put on a fantasy set ever.
That's right. She was in Roadhouse also. Then she was in Fatherhood, which was another Patrick Swayze movie. Species. Then she did a bunch of TV shows and stuff like that also. So, yeah. Right. And then we get the assistants. Bruce Willis has his two assistants. And then we have a trainer for Bruce Willis. You know, which it's really funny that he, you know, that he gets a trainer here for this. You know, because if you want him to be an everyman, then why do you need him to have a trainer? The idea is, okay.
I will say, by comparison to the action stars from the turn of the millennium on, Bruce Willis very much does look like the everyman in this. Like, yeah, he's a little buffer than most, but he's not ripped.
And that's why it works so well, because you look at him and you're like, okay, that could be me. You know, it's not Sylvester Stallone or Jean-Claude Van Damme, or, I mean, all of them made Die Hard type movies, which maybe we'll talk about later this episode, but, you know, they don't look, they're ripped, as you said. You know, you see veins bulging. I mean, even in Cliffhanger, where Stallone is supposed to be an everyman, okay, you see those muscles, you see those veins, you know, jumping out of his arms.
I mean, credit to the trainer, because, like, there you have to do certain exercises to either get ripped or just get fit, so to speak. And, you know, I don't know how Bruce spent the bulk of this movie other than, you know, covered in blood. But, like, he does manage some feats, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, but is Bruce Willis doing them or not? You know, a lot of them you can tell that it's a stuntman because the wig is slightly off. But, you know, we've discussed some of those, you know.
I mean, look, this is the other thing, too. And you probably talked about this, but my favorite part about this movie is that, like, you know, Bruce Willis is going to his trailer and noodling on the guitar because he still harbors his rock star dream at this point.
Yes.
In his career.
Bruno. Like, Bruno.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying like he's like all in on it, but he still hasn't given up on Bruno yet at this point in his movie career. And that's so exciting to me for some reason. And I don't know why.
I know why, because you're also someone who still aspires to, you know, after 20 years, you're still aspiring to be a musician. So why not? You know?
Yeah.
You know, you'd be going off in your trailer and playing your guitar also while you're reading your biographies. So, you know,
that's fair.
and I don't mean that as you know, it's not something negative. That's just that's why you would think that. I completely understand that. You can definitely relate to Bruce Willis. You know, this is moonlighting Bruce Willis.
This is the only time I could probably relate to Bruce Willis. Every movie after here.
Because you have hair.
They're apart.
Because you have hair. I can relate to him more, you know, from the hair perspective. Okay. But whatever. I mean, it's – no, because also most – the movies that he made before this movie pretty much bombed. You know, he was in Blind Date, and he was in what was that other movie that he was in at the time? I can't remember right now.
Was Hudson Hawk before or after?
No, Hudson Hawk was after. You can't make Hudson Hawk unless you're a star.
Okay.
You know, that movie is just completely nuts. It's fun, but nuts. You know, that's
yes.
But yeah. So he was basically filming Moonlighting at the same time that they were filming this. You know, so he was doing what Michael J. Fox did during Back to the Future, you know, jumping back and forth, you know, record, you know, filming at night here and filming during the day there. And, you know, and I'm assuming he didn't expect this to really work out, you know. Sunset's the other movie. It was Blind Date and Sunset. You know,
I mean, the only other person I know that shot two things simultaneously that I was a fan of is Veronica Mars and Fanboys overlapped for her. But people don't think of it that way because Veronica Mars ended before Fanboys finally got released.
Right.
So they were shot simultaneously for her, obviously. And this is Kristen Bell, obviously.
Yeah.
But like it, because Fanboys doesn't come out for a while, it took a while to get released. But Fanboys is a personal favorite. So like, that's one of the reasons that it just kind of resonates for me.
Right. Okay. That's fair. That's definitely fair. But again, it's not the same type of, also the '80s were different than the aughts. You know, yes, when you do absolutely. Things like that, you know, in the '80s, it was more uncommon for a TV star to moonlight as a film star. You know, at that point you did either this or that, you know, you weren't, obviously people are probably screaming at their radios right now saying, what are you talking about? You know, this guy, Don Johnson did this and John, and, you know, throwing out all these different names of people who did it. But, you know, even Denzel did it. You know, he was on St. Elsewhere at the same time that he did, you know, like Glory and, you know, a lot of his movies in the '80s. But okay. But,
yeah,
you know, but I guess not everyone had as much success as Bruce Willis did. Especially, I mean, Michael J. Fox, he did really well in Back to the Future. But Family Ties still continued for a number of seasons. You know, it wasn't that, yeah. Okay, that was it. He's out of there. Bruce Willis left.
And you have to like what you're doing too. Like, that's the thing. If you don't like the series you're on, that's your ticket out.
That's
basically.
Right. That's right. That's right. Right. So, and then we have a whole long list of production assistants, followed by a whole bunch of other. I'm not saying this to be negative about any of these people, but they talk about the transportation and the craft services and stuff like that. And then the weapons training.
My favorite here is First Aid by Marilyn B. Frank. And all I want to know is, with the amount of fake blood used in this film, do you have to like clean the actor completely in order to know like what is real blood? Because like all I think is, if he got a cut on his feet or even if it was the stunt guy, right? How would you know what was real and what wasn't?
That's right.
That's all.
That's right.
And that goes for, that's kind of a universal statement, I think, for first aid people on all action movies, but it always crosses my mind when I guess real quick for the audience, my parents trained me to sit through the credits since they do that. Because of one film.
Marvel. Just kidding.
No.
I'm kidding.
Animal House. At the very That's end right. of Animal House.
That's right.
It says, say hi to Babs.
That's right. No, it says when visiting Universal Studios.
Okay.
Say hi to Babs.
Say hi.
Come on. So, Jason, you got to get it right.
it is still say hi to Babs. I just didn't. Fair enough. But the point is, so I've always sat through the credits and you know, I always kind of pay attention to it. And look, there's a lot you can learn by sitting through the credits. And one of them, on a bigger picture, not this, maybe more of a globe-trotting picture, my favorite thing is where it's shot.
Right.
Like the special thanks to certain tourism bureaus or film bureaus or whatever.
Or government film agencies, you know.
Yes, exactly. Because this gives you the idea, right? Like this was basically all shot on a sound stage for the most part. But like you get some of these other movies where you're like, it was set in Africa and yet it's like Vancouver and New Zealand, and like you're like, okay, they didn't set foot That's on right. that continent.
Exactly. Right?
But these are some of the things you can learn by sitting through the credits, and it's not all just about what that extra thing may be that Marvel has kind of spoiled. I want Marvel to not put one at the end, just to start breaking the expectation.
But part of the problem is, I've seen. I saw a few weeks ago Black Adam. Okay, I know it's not Marvel, it's DC, but you know DC has taken on the persona of Marvel from that perspective. You know that they will have end cre- they've mid credit scenes and stuff like that. And, more than half the theater just gets up and walks out. They don't even, it's not as if this is the first Marvel movie and everyone's about to shock you that, wow, there's going to be a credit scene. It's there. Sit down.
That's fair.
Don't get up. 5 minutes of your time. You just spent 2.5 hours watching an action movie. You can wait 5 more minutes to see if there's something else. Now I looked up Marilyn B. Frank, and this is her only credit in IMDb. Apparently, she's either really good at first aid, and they drafted her to like work in a hospital, or she was really bad at it, and she just never was able to find any more work in that.
Well, I tip my cap to you, Mrs. Frank.
Yes. Right. And then, we get all the transportation the captains and transportation coordinator. And now this is one of the things that jumped out at me. The picture car coordinator. Okay.
Yes.
Do you have any idea what that means?
I'm just going to guess it's the cars in the picture as opposed to the transportation. So, as my understanding of transportation is, it's the car to get Mr. Willis from point A to point B, or from his hotel, or from where he's staying to his trailer or to the set. I think the picture car coordinator, in would my guess would be the cars that are actually in the film,
Right. Okay. You
and
are right.
that's
You are
my
right.
guess,
Okay. That's
right?
right.
And
Sorry.
I will also say that this is 1988, and that title has probably changed 17 times in the last whatever, because the picture car coordinator for like Fast and the Furious might be just the stunt car coordinator, some other weird. Like, I
Right.
mean, I just
Exactly.
expect that this is a title that has changed as we've kind of done more quote unquote car movies.
Right. That's very possible. I didn't look into that. I looked into what exactly is the job of someone who is a picture car coordinator. So they have also what's known as the vintage picture car coordinator, or just the regular picture car coordinator, So what is their job? Their job is to train the stars and stunt drivers to effectively drive the various cars and motorcycles that are in movies. They set up an
Okay.
emergency repair shop or a body shop near the movie set in order to fix things that need to be fixed, overnight and stuff like that. They coordinate all the vehicle transportation for the movie needs,
Okay.
and they work directly with the director and the rest of the support team with anything related to cars on the movie set. Okay. Now, part of the things that they also do is they're the ones who do the scouting and find the cars. They're vehicle wranglers, basically.
Okay.
They go and
I just like the idea that th this is the guy who's in Argyle's ear going, "Yes, hit the van."
That's right. Yes. Okay. So they buy the cars that they use in the movie. So this is the guy who bought the limo. This is the guy who bought the
Okay.
truck. This is the guy who bought, the
Oh,
disappearing
I want
or
to.
the what's the right word? The teleporting ambulance.
I
Okay.
just like the
You
idea that
know what
it's
I'm
like,
talking about when I say the teleporting ambulance, right?
yeah, I like the idea that like he had to go to a like a dealer and go, "I need a van." What kind of van? One that will fit in this other truck. Like, it's not like I just need it to fit in this other vehicle. That's what I
That's right.
need.
And I need to be able to put ramps to take it out. I mean, you're aware of the fact that when they originally started filming the movie and had the original script, they didn't have the ambulance. They didn't know how they were going to get
Oh
out.
yeah, they all walk out of that. Like, there's a cut. What you don't know, I'm gonna break some news for you, Rob. What you don't know is there's a cut scene of them taking out like Tinker Toys and building that van. That's a kit van. It was in the subfloor
It's a
of the
transformer.
truck.
It's a transformer. It was Hans's briefcase.
Yes.
Yeah. So they sometimes will rent cars or buy them for the movie. It's a really cool idea that this is, I mean, these are basically car experts that can do this
Yeah.
job. It's just
And they have to be clearly and not only work with the director and probably the writer of the script, but they also have to have like a plan B, either that has been discussed with the director or that they have in their head. Like, if you can't get that limo. You still need a limo or something for that.
You need to have a backup plan. I mean, you need to have a plan B.
Yep, always.
Yeah. No, so I just found that really cool. That's one of the things I love about watching credits. You learn new things about, you know, who would have thought that there is a job like this? I mean, it makes sense when you think about it. But you know, if someone were to ask you, how did he get the cars in the movies? You wouldn't say, oh, well, there's a guy that this is his job to go and look for, you know, they tell him we need a 1985 limo to be used here. So, okay, I'm going to go out and find one. I'm going to rent one. I'm going to buy one. And I need to have a spare one in case something happens to that one.
Well, and
you know, if it hits the ambulance and we don't like the way that, you know, the damage is done there, we need another one, you know,
or
I got to spend the weekend fixing that. You know?
Well, and I think the other piece to that is Phil Tippett, right?
Yeah.
Dinosaur supervisor, right? Like, this is specific to Jurassic Park and almost every movie in that franchise, but his title is literally dinosaur supervisor.
Right.
If you don't watch the credits, you don't realize that might be the coolest credit anyone could ever have.
Yeah, it's definitely a very cool credit. I would totally agree with you on that. I mean, I used to like watching movies like Airplane and The Naked Gun for the credits also, because there they would have like great credits. You know, you just have, you're watching the credits and they're just like things that are there that shouldn't be. You know, I think The Naked Gun, I think, has a list of cast members by their quotes. You know, like people who just have a one line quote. So you can go there and they say, hey, that's Enrico Pagliazzo. You know, when Drebin takes off his mask, you know, as the umpire, and someone screams, hey, that's Enrico Pagliazzo. And so like in the credits, it says his quote and then it says the guy's name. So it was just really funny. You know, I think it was in Hot Shots Part Deux that they like ruined the movie, The Crying Game. Right. So the quote was, is the secret from The Crying Game. She's a he, you know, and that's like in the middle of the credits, you know? So, I mean, the Zookers were great at credits.
In a very similar way, this is why I always read book acknowledgements. Cause a good chunk of the book acknowledgments, like movie credits, are just thanks to my editor and my publisher. But sometimes they're like, thanks to my dog who, you know, whatever. Like,
who didn't crap on the carpet while I was writing. You know, it's like,
I mean, you don't know, like, you can skip over that completely, but it's like three paragraphs. Come on.
Yeah.
Are 5 minutes.
But the problem with these credits is you don't really know what these people, you know, did. You know, if you're talking about a book credit and you're saying thank you to my dog because you were so supportive and you let me finish writing the paragraph before I had to go take you for a walk, you know, then you understand the context. Here, you
get some context. Yeah.
Here, a lot of times in movies, you'll see thanks to, and you'll be like, okay, why is it thanks to? I mean, obviously the two people, you know, the person who is giving the thanks and the person who is being thanked have an idea as what they're talking about, but we have no idea whatsoever.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, we're coming up to the probably one of the few names in this credit, not an actor, that I know.
All right. Who is that?
Michael Kamen.
There you go. Michael Kamen. I love Michael Kamen. He has so many great scores.
It's not just that Michael Kamen was the guy in charge of the orchestra for Metallica's S&M album. And it's just to be able to put up with that group of guys to put that concert together and that album together, I have more respect for him than any of the other times I see his name pop up for a score.
Wow. Right. I mean, he has 96 composing credits and 125 soundtrack credits on IMDb.
And he needs to get more credit. Like, I know he's not John Williams, but like, his name is usually not in the top five, and it should be.
Yeah, but I think that's like, partially also because he passed away almost 20 years ago. So I think maybe at the time, you know, maybe in the 1990s, his name was in the conversation, but now
it could have been.
But now in 2020s, it's not. You know, that's I think part of the issue. You know, he has some great scores. I mean, have you ever heard the score for either Band of Brothers or From the Earth to the Moon? Okay, he did both of those. Those are such amazing scores, you know, that he did. I've always been a big fan of Michael Gammon. And I mean, we'll talk a little bit in we'll get there. We're not there yet. But there is stuff I want to talk about with him that's related to a few of the songs that we're going to be talking about shortly. So we won't jump too far into that. But I mean, if you know, so he's great. I'm really glad that I mean, he did a great job with the music, because the music here is both original and classical. You know, he found a way to combine the two. And and then after that we get all the editors. You know, we have the sound effects editors and the people who do all the ADR and the post-production dialogue. I mean, those are people that I have a lot of respect for, especially since I started, you know, editing my podcast. You know, you just have to have a lot of time and patience to do it. Obviously, it helps that you're getting paid to do it. That's true. You know, I mean,
Well,
you and I
I
do
think
it, you and I do it in our spare time, so it's a little different.
I mean the other piece to this is the Foley guys, because as an example, when you shoot that much glass, it won't sound pretty into a microphone. You have to redo that in a way, and this movie sounds amazing, really. I mean, it really does.
Especially given the fact that it came out 34 years ago. You know, that's just not something you would have, you know, this movie in some ways sounds better than some recent movies. You know, because they did just a
And
great
I think
job
part of
with
that
it.
is because I think it also depends on where you watch it. I'll admit, I mean, there are a lot of theaters I think that maybe turn things up a little too loud. And that's not my age. It's just like if the loud part of the movie peaks, you're probably playing it too loud. And because I refuse to believe that professional ADR or professional Foley people are like, yes, I want the sound to peak right now.
Probably. Yeah, I don't think they have much of a say in that.
Probably not.
No. And then when we finish with all the sound guys, then we had something that just jumped out at me. It says knives provided by Jack W. Crane, Weatherford, Texas. Okay. So my first question is, okay, you've seen this movie more recently than I have, because you just rewatched the whole movie. Okay.
I
I
did.
obviously I've probably seen the movie more times than you, but you've seen it more recently. I was racking my brain when I was doing my research for this, trying to remember, where is there a knife in this movie? In Die Hard 2, there are
Okay,
knives.
so
Is there a
here we
knife here?
go. I literally watched the movie and then I watched the credits because I knew what we would be talking about, and knives came up. I'm whatever the end of the movie to this coming up on screen is, and I went, what knife?
Exactly. There is no knife here. The closest thing they get to the knife is the letter opener or scissors that Holly is playing with when the two of them are talking in Ellis's when she and John are talking in Ellis's office. That's the closest you can come to a knife. Okay. I couldn't figure it out.
I couldn't either.
Where the hell is there a knife in this movie? Why do you have to have a knife for, you know?
I mean, the only thing I can think of is maybe they were fancy knives for the spread at like the very beginning.
Mean
Like
during the
it's just,
party?
it's not
You're saying knives
featured.
in the
Yeah, they're
party?
part, it's just there somewhere on like a charcuterie board. And it's just like, well, that was provided by somebody, so we got to give them credit.
Okay, well, I will counter that, because I it's a nice try. It's not the right answer,
Okay.
unfortunately, because this same guy, Jack W. Crane, okay, has 13 different movie credits. All of them,
Wow.
he is the, you know, the I guess the knife expert. Okay, and I'll just give you a list of them. All right, and you'll tell me whether it's possible that the knives they're talking about here are silverware. All right,
Okay.
Predator, Commando, Action Jackson, Die Hard, Roadhouse, Die Hard 2, The Adventures of Fort Fairlane, Predator 2, Hudson Hawk, Ricochet, Last Boy Scout, Demolition Man, and Executive Decision. So, which of these movies do they have a dinner party?
I mean,
in every one of those movies, I can think of where there's a knife. In this movie, I can't. It's driving. It drives me nuts.
It has to be a cutting room floor thing. Like, it has to be.
Yeah, but he still gets his credit.
Still gets his credit.
But I can't even think of any place, unless they were to have, you know, John and Carl fighting with knives. That's the closest I can think of.
Any of those, yeah, it's possible that in any of those close combat ones, somebody pulls out a knife and they were like, we just don't like the way it came together. Let's cut it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just really weird.
Although, for the record, though, a lot of Bruce Willis movies in that list.
Yes, and John McTiernan movies. And yep. We even have two Rennie Harlan films, Die Hard 2 and Ford Fairlane. Okay.
Demolition Man and Last Boy Scout are definitely two of my favorites.
Oh, I love those. I love those movies. I saw both of them relatively recently. I rewatched them. They're just fun movies to watch.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Demolition Man is up there for me. Like that's one of my comfort movies. If it's on if it's in syndication, no matter where it is, I will watch it. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. It's a great movie to watch. You know, and if you know it well enough, you don't need to, you know, watch it from the beginning. You know, but the problem is every time I watch it, I still want to know what the three seashells do. You know, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great concept, but, you know, you just don't know what they're talking about.
I mean, so the movie I made was a documentary, but if I ever get to make a piece of fiction, I want to create something that's a small detail like that I don't actually that I don't have to answer.
Right.
So everybody else can make it up for me, which is what that has become, which is wonderful.
Correct. Like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. Yeah.
Yep.
That type of thing. Yeah, makes sense. And then the next credit is Special Ceramic Vessels. And then it has a list of people that is provided by one in LA and one in New York.
Yep.
I also couldn't think of any ceramic vessels that they use in this movie. Again, maybe at the dinner party, maybe.
No, what I was thinking was that perhaps some of the C4 stuff, or some of the explosives, or some of that stuff was just made of ceramic. But I think if in order to answer the ceramic question, you need to look at where all the bullets end up, because bullets enter ceramic in a way that is pleasing, visually to film, that say other things wouldn't.
Okay.
So I think that's some fair. Of it's that. But I good for the next credit, right? Butterfly Wings Bridge Model.
That's right. Now, but that one, that's like, this is of these three, this is the first one where I can actually tell you where it's from.
Accepting that there are other models that did not get credit, unless those are all ceramic.
Those are the ceramic ones. That's right.
Like Nakatomi Plaza's right there in model form.
That's right.
Nobody gets a credit for it, by the way.
That's right. Well, no, they probably have, you know, someone who does, it's not craft services. Craft services is food, but the person who does the arts and crafts, you know, there's someone there.
Yeah.
Someone who got credit for it, but apparently the Butterfly Wing Bridge, they had to specifically get credit for it. You know, and I love that, you know, the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation. It means that Nakatomi had so much money that they were able to steal the Butterfly Wing Bridge, you know, for Indonesia. You know, that's their new plant in Indonesia. Who knows? And then we get into the song credits. So the first two songs, we'll go into them into more detail in a second. But
well, let me ask you a question before we do that.
Okay.
Were you surprised by a song that didn't make the, like, Ode to Joy is hummed through, like, I don't remember seeing it in the credits. I know that might be getting ahead, but I don't
it's
remember.
In tomorrow.
See,
it's
there
in
was
tomorrow.
Some flash. Okay, all right. Because it's just, I don't know. There were some other classical things that I feel like didn't make the list. It seemed like a very truncated music list.
Yes. Oh, you know what? You're right. I'm looking at tomorrow's. It is not there. There is no Ode to Joy here.
Yeah, and yet, it's such a huge musical. Look, I know it's not like the biggest musical
Do you
piece to
think
the movie.
maybe because it didn't need to, it doesn't need to be credited because of the fact that it's,
Hummed?
no, because of the fact that it's what's going on? It's no longer under copyright, meaning anyone can use it.
Might be public domain.
Yeah, if it's public domain, maybe then you don't need to, maybe you don't
I don't
need to
know
give
if
it credit. But forget about that. Let's
I don't know if I was
talk
if I
about the
was
fact.
Rickman.
Let's just talk about the fact that they have two songs here, "Singing in the Rain" and "Winter Wonderland." Okay, again, we'll go back to what we were just talking about with the knives. Okay, you just watched this movie. Do you recall where those two songs are played?
I believe Winter Wonderland is playing at the party. Singing in the Rain must also be based on the order that these are in.
Okay,
That's the only thing I can think of.
neither of them is in the movie.
So it's not there.
It's
I mean, because they're playing classical orchestrations, the band that Nakatomi gets. By the way, okay, again, Nakatomi might as well just be where John Hammond got spared no expense, because that's not even like a quartet. That's like a 12-piece string band that they're like, we'll put you on the balcony.
Yes.
Play whatever you want.
Yeah, but we never see them. We don't see them walking, running around with all the other hostages,
No,
carrying their cello.
it's, they just disappear.
Yeah. They let the music guys go. We don't need you as hostages. But again, okay. So what I started saying before when we were talking about Michael Kamen, and now I'm going to bring it up. Okay. So Michael Kamen, when he was invited to be in this movie, he originally refused. He said, "I can't do Ode to Joy. This isn't what it, it doesn't work. You can't use classical music in a movie like this." And then he thought about it a little bit, and he decided that he would agree to do this on the condition that they would get licenses to use the song "Singing in the Rain" and "Winter Wonderland." Okay. And then what he did was is he mixed the melodies of "Ode to Joy," "Winter Wonderland," and "Singing in the Rain" into the score that he made of this movie, which mostly underscores the villains. Okay,
Yeah,
so
no,
they
absolutely.
bought the rights to these songs, but don't use them. They use bits and pieces of the music from them.
So what you're telling me is Michael Kamen was ahead of the game as far as crediting remixes and sampling.
This is more sampling. I wouldn't even call it remixing because it's not, you don't hear that. I guess you have to
Well,
be
except
really
that you can pick
attuned.
out Ode to Joy,
Right.
you know. But
Exactly.
yeah, no,
Right.
yeah.
Right.
I mean, but what's exciting about all of this, or not so exciting for Mike if you're Michael Kamen, is that Christmas in the Hollis is literally the song people think of when they think of this movie as a Christmas movie.
Correct. And that is why it's my intro music and my outro music. Christmas in Hollis. A good Jewish boy like me using, Christmas or modern day Christmas music.
That's well, you know, I mean, look, we of the tribe, we know a lot of people in our tribe that wrote a lot of that music,
Yes,
so it's
that's
not
true also.
like we can't use
Yeah, of course.
it.
No. But I don't think Run DMC fit into that. But that's I'm pretty
No.
sure. Right. So let's talk a little bit about the songs, about "Singing in the Rain." And now apparently, "Singing in the Rain" is mostly associated with Theo in this movie. The
Okay.
undertones of "Singing in the Rain" come out quite often in scenes with Theo. I never really paid as much attention to it as I probably should have. So I couldn't tell you at which point you can hear "Singing in the Rain," because he does hum certain things along the way, but not "Singing in the Rain." Do you know when the song actually was originally created?
No.
Okay, so
I don't.
it first was created in 1929. All right, the lyrics were written by Arthur Freed and the music by Nacio Herb Brown. Yeah,
Interesting.
33 years later, they made a movie with the name of the song, which
Yeah.
ironically takes place in the 20s. So, you know, I think that that's also pretty funny that they are able to make that connection there.
Yeah.
You know, and apparently,
I
I
know
mean, you
everything
would
there
know.
is to know about Winter Wonderland,
That's right.
by the way.
You would know more about this than I would. The apparently the song has a very unusual form. Okay, because you're
Which
more
one?
of a musical person. So it apparently has a 32-bar chorus rather than being preceded by a verse and containing an internal bridge, which was standard at the time. So it opened the 32-bar chorus opens the song, which is followed by a 24-bar verse that has a feeling of a bridge before the chorus repeats. Now, I just read that. I have no idea what it means. The question is, do you, being a music person?
Recently, I've been picking up my bass a lot more. So I've been kind of trying to get back into playing that particular instrument. And I will tell you, maybe back then that was the case. But now, even in contemporary songs, people don't do what was once normal.
Right.
So
I'm talking
normally,
about the fact that when it came out in 1929, you know, that was the norm.
I
And it,
think
he did, they went
the
against it.
norm back then would have been intro, verse, chorus, verse, bridge, verse, chorus, verse, or some pattern like that. So I could see how it would have been different then. But I'm just saying, like, looking back, even now in contemporary songs, that's not the case anymore. We end up with songs from like Dylan that are just one continuous verse. You know what I mean? So
That's Bob
and I think
Dylan
people, yeah,
for
so I think people pick up on that kind of stuff as on an artistic level. That stuff has very much changed since then. Yeah.
it's true. All right, so let's move on to Winter Wonderland. So, do you know when?
Everything. What do you want to know?
Okay, when was it written?
1934.
Wait, did you know that by heart, or you looked it up?
No, I know that by heart because okay, so the thing about it is, right?
I looked it up. I'll be honest about
I Richard Smith was the lyricist,
That is correct.
okay? He was inspired to write the song by the town I went to high school in.
Oh wow. I think we've talked about this.
It's possible. Yeah, so I
Did we
went to
talk about this
school.
in did we talk about this in The
My
Great
high school
Escape? I
was
don't remember. I know I've heard this
my high
from you.
school.
So
Yeah, my high school was Honesdale High School. And Honesdale is the town that, when it snowed, inspired him to write Winter Wonderland. And when you go to high school there, you just learn this. It's kind of like, I mean, the only other thing that the town has two other things to claim to fame. One is the first steam, home to the first steam engine in North America, and it's the county seat of Wayne County, Pennsylvania. So Winter Wonderland is probably the bigger
wow.
of those things colloquially, right? And as far as pop culture. So that's why I know that. That's it. That's all I got. That's where it ends. I'm
But
done.
that's great. I'm trying to rack my brain trying to figure out when I heard you talking about this, whether we talked
I mean,
about
I
it
have
or
talked
whether
about
it's
it
something
on.
on your show, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it might. I mean, I did talk about it at one point on my show, at some point.
Could
So.
be. Well, apparently it has been covered by over 200 different artists in the 88 years since it was written. It was written,
That makes sense.
yeah.
Although I'm surprised, I'll be honest, that number seems very low to me
It
because
says over.
for
It says
my.
over.
Okay, all right, it's just over. All right. Well, because, and the thing I keep thinking is Winter Wonderland is like a staple. And from the mid 1980s through the 2000s, at the height of the CD era, everybody was like, I'm going to put out a Christmas album.
Right.
And this was one of those songs that they would put out on their Christmas album. So anybody with a Christmas album has a chance to have covered this song.
Now
Feels like it should be thousands.
which version do you think is played most commonly nowadays?
Bing Crosby's.
No, the version
Just
by
kidding.
the Eurythmics. They did a version in 1987. and that is known as the most commonly played version of this song, which is very interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
Because in November 20, 2007, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, they listed the song as the most played ASCAP member written holiday song for the previous 5 years. And they cited that the Rhythmics 1987 version was the one that was mostly played. But again, we're talking, 15 years ago.
And it is as far as holiday songs go, it's fairly non-denominational.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it makes absolute sense that they would be the most played.
Because you can play them at your Christmas party. You can play them at your Hanukkah party. You can play them at your Kwanzaa party.
And you can play them for Thanksgiving when it snows.
Right.
Like, I mean, this is one of those things where because it's weather related and not holiday related, you can get away with playing at any.
Well, so was Singing in the Rain. It's weather related.
Well, that's true too.
Maybe that was what Kamen wanted. He wanted to instill, weather into Ode to Joy.
I mean, I hope you. I know. I'm sure you talked about it because, spoiler alert for everybody. I don't listen to what Rob says with other guests because I don't want my own opinion of the movie. Not that it would change it, but I don't want to. So I don't know what's been covered. But my favorite part about the ending of Die Hard is the paper standing in for snow.
That's correct. But that's not regular paper. Do you know what that is?
No.
That's the bear bonds.
Oh, well, there were not that many bear bonds.
There were. There were a lot.
I mean, there were a lot, but there weren't that many. Yeah, it's not like there were 6 million of them and each of them is worth a dollar.
No.
Also, like, seriously, that's a very small amount of money.
Yes.
Like, I know this is 1988, but, like, that's a very small amount of money for this kind of effort. Is all
amazing. No, we'll go back to if you want to talk about Austin Powers, that whole thing, the $1 million. Yeah. So but that's what we're looking at from our perspective. In the 1980s, $600 million was a lot of money.
Okay.
I think months and months ago when I talked about it, I figured out how much $600 million is worth, nowadays, and it's obviously in the billions. Yeah.
Okay.
But that's fair. I'm assuming also it's supposed to be the bearer bonds. It's not the bearer bonds. It really is paper because they don't have real bearer bonds to use. They're all props. Go back to the prop guy that we just talked about earlier.
Why would the bearer bonds be falling down from the sky? I mean, I know there was an explosion and everything, but like a lot of that stuff's just falling, and all of that stuff was in the vault.
No, but when Hans fell out the window, so you're 30 stories up, there's a lot of air pressure, and a lot of wind and stuff like that that everything is flying out.
it's fair,
but you're right, it makes it, this is the way that you can have snow in California, in LA.
I will say though, there are two comments I have to make about the movie. One, a cell phone doesn't change this movie, and I love that about this film. Because if he picks up and calls 911 from a cell phone, even if he identifies himself, no one's going to believe him, just like the radio operator didn't believe
him. In 1988.
I think that's
in 2022, someone picks up the phone and says there's a terrorist event going on right now. Nobody's going to brush them off.
Inserting the cell phone back to them, not bringing the whole movie to us. That's fair.
Yeah. That's something that we discussed quite often, the fact that there is no way. I mean, everyone is completely nonchalant about the fact that there is a suspected terrorist activity. I mean, come on. They sent Powell to go check out a suspected terrorist activity, but they
by himself,
and they didn't tell him that there is reason to be cautious because someone has said that it could be a terrorist event. They have just said, they say it could be a prank call. That's it.
Well, no, it's a prank call, but the dispatcher does say, please use caution, as if like that's a ooh.
Exactly.
And then my
I love that they're part, I love that they're gonna that, that and we talked about this a lot when it happened, but I love that they said we're gonna report you to the FCC.
Yeah. But my other favorite part is and it dates this movie, and it's a throwaway line from some people, but I love Arafat. I heard Arafat gets his suits there.
Yes.
Like, I know it's a throwaway line, but it might be one of my favorite lines in this film.
Right. It's because of the way that Hans says it. It's as if he looks up to Arafat. You know, this is the guy I want to be. I want to be the world's best known terrorist. You know, that's what I want to be. Especially in 1988, when Arafat was still, everyone considered him a terrorist. Later on, you know, he sort of, you know, got a little bit of legitimacy, but in 1988, he was still a terrorist.
He might be the only terrorist in history that veered into diplomat at a certain point instead of just being terrorist.
Correct.
Like if he had to state his job description, it would be like terrorist, 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 diplomat, 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 terrorist, terrorist, terrorist. Like for a few years there,
yeah.
He got legitimized.
Yes, completely. And I mean, you know, he says about the John Phillips suits, that's just a made up brand, you know, cut of suits. It's not real.
Yeah.
You know, so that works too. Yes, those are great lines. And then we get to the third song, which we mentioned briefly, Christmas in Hollis. So what do you know about the song Christmas in Hollis?
I just expect that somebody was like, you guys should make a holiday rap album. And they were like, of course we should.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the story. That's just my expectation. Because again, and like I said, at the height of the CD era, You put out a holiday album. Everybody did, if you could.
Right, but apparently they didn't want to at first. They actually refused to do this. You know, and then the director of publicity for Rush Productions, basically, you know, said to them, "Hey, why don't you do a song like this called Christmas in Hollis?" They wanted them to be on like a holiday album, and they didn't want to do it. You know, then they agreed to do it. And I mean, on this album, they had Whitney Houston, Sting, Springsteen, Madonna, Bob Seger. You know, this was a holiday album called A Very Special Christmas Album.
Wow, it's not even like, like, I mean, Christmas in Hollywood, Christmas in the Hood. Like, I mean, something specific. No, just A Very Special Christmas Album.
It sounds like a you know, an after school special that they would have.
Yes.
Tune in tomorrow for a very special Christmas album, you know. So Hollis is actually an area in Queens, which is the neighborhood that that the Run DMC grew up in. And that is why they, you know, that's why that talks about. There are other songs that are inserted into this, you know, other song ideas that are inserted into this. You have a song called the Backdoor Santa. From 1968,
yep.
You have Frosty the Snowman, Jingle Bells, Joy to the World,
Rudolph.
Kind
of. I mean, they mentioned Rudolph, yeah. So I feel like,
yeah,
that's yeah,
yeah. And the video they did of this has them at the North Pole and in Hollis. They jump back and forth.
Nice.
You know, and they have Santa.
I don't think I've ever seen the video. I may have to dig that one.
And they have Santa on a you know, a sled that's being pulled by a dog. And it actually won the award for best video of the year in 1987 by Rolling Stone, and it beat out Michael Jackson's Bad, which was directed by Scorsese.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, it's in a few other movies. It's in Less Than Zero, this movie, The Night Before, The Grinch, Holiday Rush, obviously. Mostly, you know, holiday movies.
Yeah.
Less Than Zero, I don't think is.
Yeah, but some of the latter ones you mentioned would have all been inspired.
Yes.
As filmmakers by Die Hard,
yes.
So they're like, "Well, I'm making a holiday film. I got to put this in there."
Correct.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it works. So when the album came out or the single came out, do you know what other song is on that same side? What other Run DMC song do you think was really popular at in 1988?
I mean, 1988 would have been the Walk This Way
That is
remix.
correct. So
Yeah.
those are on the A side, and the B side is Peter Piper and King of Rock. So.
By the way, I just the only reason I know that is because I am a massive Aerosmith fan.
I love that. I love the video where they have the two, they have them in different stages, and they just like break through and start doing it together. I love that.
Yeah, it's a very for its time, it wasn't as heavy-handed as we look at back at it now, but the crossing the bridge is a lot heavier handed now when you look at it, because people try and do things more subtly than they did back then. But it was very well done. Yeah.
Correct. Okay, and then the fourth song that appears right as the credits end here is the song Skeletons by Stevie Wonder. Do
Yeah.
you know anything about that?
I know nothing about skeletons.
Okay, so the song is all about like people discovering lies and deceptions and stuff like that. All right, and
Okay.
apparently there are versions that have quotes from Oliver North, Reagan. It was a very political song
What
that
year
came
was
out in 87.
Okay, 'cause when I think what I think of Cult of Personality, right? By Living Color,
Okay.
where it's like got all those the only thing we have to fear, like they pull all those quotes from other things. The only thing we have to fear is obviously the one everybody knows, but there's other quotes there in the recording. And that would have been around that same time, give or take.
It's true.
So
I mean, the quotes they
it
use here
must
is
have been very popular.
the quotes they use here is the one from Oliver North. I'm not ashamed of anything in my professional or personal conduct. And the Reagan quote they use is the United States has not made concessions to those who hold our people captive in Lebanon.
Okay.
So, the music video has Stevie Wonder sitting on the porch of his home in like a picket fence type of neighborhood, and he like greets his neighbors, and then the whole idea is like showing the people's skeletons in their closets and secrets and stuff like that. Like they show a woman who's supposed to look like this perfect mother who is secretly an alcoholic. And then you have a businessman who, you would think is the, pillar of the community, who you can see that he's cross-dressing in his house. And then you have like the all-American next girl next door, who's being molested by someone.
Gotcha.
And then they show the athletic all-American boy who's like snorting cocaine. So. Some interesting choices
Yeah.
for him to use that. Do you know when this is played? I mean, with Christmas in Hollis, that was played when Argyle was driving John to Nakatomi.
Yeah.
That when and he just like, then John asked him, can you put on some Christmas music? And he goes, "This is Christmas music."
This is,
When is Skeletons
I'm
played?
going to ask this as a question. This isn't happening. This doesn't play when Hellas is snorting, does it?
No, that would have been great though. That would have
Like
been perfect. But no. No. So it's playing when Argyle is in the limo and he's talking on the phone.
okay. Oh yeah, baby, I'll make it to
That's
Vegas.
right.
My
No,
I mean my boy, my
my
boss,
boss
I'm on
thinks
my
I'm
way
on
to
my way
Vegas.
to Vegas. That's right.
Yeah.
So that's what we have with that. So what is there anything else you want to talk about related to the movie? Because we now
Yeah,
finished the credits of this minute, and we got
so
no script today.
the thing about this movie for me is it's one of those films that you watch on an almost annual basis that because we rarely sit down and watch this film, like because this has become like a Christmas movie or a holiday movie, you watch it with people and people have seen it enough that you talk through it. So when I sat down to watch this, there's always scenes that like you forget about. And there aren't any that really jump at me, excepting that, like, this has been in syndication for so long that obviously some of the things are cut out. But, like...
Do you remember when you first saw this movie?
No. And I think that's one of those weird things, right? Like, I just... This is going to sound weird, but, like, I think I've always known Die Hard. I wouldn't have seen it when it came out, because I was 5. But, like...
I hope your parents didn't take you to see it when you were 5.
And so I also didn't see it in the theater, but, like, I've seen it. I don't know if it's, like, it was in syndication. I watched bits and pieces of it here and there, and then all of a sudden I sat down and watched it one day. I don't know, but it's always kind of been a thing. In fact, when I was building up my original DVD collection that most people don't have anymore, I bought the box set of Die Hard 1, 2, and 3.
Okay, that's fair.
And so that's what I watched this. I still have that DVD, and that's what I watched the other night, which is exciting. And so, you know, I got to watch it with, like, ads for, like, other DVDs, which is always kind of fun, too. Yeah. No, I don't remember when I first saw it.
Did you convince Steph to watch it with you, or did you watch it by yourself?
Yes. No. She watched it with me. Well, I am notoriously not a holiday person. So when I was like, hey, do you want to watch a Christmas movie? She's like, I didn't say Christmas. I said, you want to watch a holiday movie? And so she knows it's probably one of 3 films. And she's like, yes, absolutely. Because the 3 holiday films, maybe 4 holiday films that I will watch are Die Hard, Iron Man 3, Hebrew Hammer, and Diner. Those are the 4 holiday movies I will watch. Other than that, you can put all those other ones on in the background. That's fine. But, like, those are the 4 I will watch.
Plane, Train, and Automobiles isn't on that.
I think of that more as far as, like, Thanksgiving. And
that's
Thanksgiving
holiday. You're talking about winter holiday? So you don't have any
winter holiday.
Where's your Kwanzaa movie?
I would say that there's enough overlap in Hebrew Hammer to cover some Kwanzaa, if I'm being honest. But I would say, like, Son-in-Law would be my favorite Thanksgiving movie.
Okay. That would be an interesting choice.
Just going to throw that out there, right? Like, so she was very excited to watch it. And it's become a classic, and I think that rightfully so.
Yes. Yes. Okay, well, that's a great segue for us to get into, you know, because your episode is a special Saturday episode, so we didn't, you know, you don't get all the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday stuff, so I decided that I'm going to let you do all of them today, if you want, you know, so we'll start with that.
I'm ready.
All right, so the segment that we do on Mondays is Die Hard on a Monday, okay? Everyone knows that Die Hard is one of the few films that has actually been able to create its own genre. There was no Die Hard type genre beforehand. And ever since, you know, people would, you know, try to get movies made by saying, oh, this is Die Hard on a bus, and this is Die Hard on an airplane, and this is Die Hard in Antarctica. It doesn't really matter. You know, anything, you know, you just have to say that. So it became its own genre. So I've been asking over this entire season, every one of my guests, to list their 5 favorite movies that fit in, that have been built from this genre. And tomorrow I will give everyone the tally of, you know, of how many there were, which there are, I think, maybe over 50 different movies were chosen throughout the course of every one of my guests. And, you know, now we have another one to add. So, Jason, why don't you give us your top 5 Die Hard doppelganger films? Start from number 5 and work your way up.
All right. So number 5, we've got Die Hard with Cyber Criminals. And that's just, frankly, Live Free or Die Hard, because I absolutely adore that film. And I feel like if you don't include an actual Die Hard sequel in your Die Hard genre films, then what's the point?
Okay, that's fair. So I think that means you'll be back in a few seasons to talk about that movie when I do it. Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. I'm glad to see that the 5th one isn't on there. You know, that one.
Yeah. No, number 4, Die Hard in the Far East, and that's The Legend of Drunken Master. And then number three is Die Hard in Beverly Hills, because Beverly Hills Cop is so good. So good. Number two, Die Hard.
Even though that does come, that came out before Die Hard.
It's fair.
It's okay. Beverly Hills Cop came out in 84. Yeah. But it's, I'm giving it to you because I think you're right. Because these are also the only two movies that talk about bearer bonds.
Well, and I think the other part is, and this is my favorite part about Beverly Hills Cop and Die Hard, is it's a cop out of jurisdiction who is still not following the rules.
Correct.
Like,
and that's what my captain keeps telling me.
And they also didn't follow the rules when they were. Yeah, exactly. Right. Like they're the same. It's so. Yeah. So anyway, number two, Die Hard at Alcatraz with The Rock. And number one, my favorite Die Hard on a plane, which is Con Air.
Ooh, my good friends of the show, Jay and Mark, will be very happy to hear that. You do know that they're doing a Con Air show. They're doing Con Air pod. It's called Con Air Pod. And, you know, they do it chapter by chapter. They don't do it minute by minute, okay. But it's great. I was actually just a guest a few weeks ago. It's a lot of fun with them. You should listen to at least one episode. You'll love it because they go all over the place with it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, you know, In fact, when we're recording this, it's months on from this happening, but I was super excited when Aaron Rodgers showed up to training camp dressed as Nick Cage from Con Air with the long hair and the white beater, because I was like, this is brilliant, and it got trending, and people were talking about – and then people just stopped talking about Aaron Rodgers and just started talking about Con Air, and it was wonderful for like – an hour.
Why not?
So there I am. The Live Free or Die Hard, Legend of the Drunken Master, Beverly Hills Cop, The Rock, and Con.
Those are great choices, and everyone come back tomorrow to hear where, if any of those five make it into the top five of all of my guests, of what they think about Die Hard doppelganger films. So thank you very much for that, Jason. So we'll move into Tuesdays. Tuesday is Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where my guest gives a little story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something that happened to them in their lives that is somewhat related to some holiday. Doesn't matter what. It could be any holiday.
Yeah, for me, it is about the Hebrew Hammer, which – is a like a Comedy Central financed film, by the way. I don't believe it was like a major motion picture. And I stumbled upon it on Comedy Central at one point, and then literally went out and bought the DVD the next day because I was like, I finally have a movie for me. And people are like, oh, Eight Crazy Nights. It's like, yeah, but it's just not the same. And the level of humor in the Hebrew Hammer, I guess the difference would be, and I always try and explain this to people, Eight Crazy Nights is Adam Sandler, and it's not a bad film, but it's made for everyone, and the Hebrew Hammer is made for Jews.
Okay.
And I don't say that lightly. Like, the humor that's in it, if you don't New Yorkers, because I know a lot of New Yorkers that aren't Jewish, that also understand Jewish humor, but like, you have to know that there is that might be the one writer's room I would love to be a part of retroactively is like coming up with these things. But just being able to have that film and then conversely with the Hebrew Hammer, as many people who are Jewish and who aren't Jewish may know, we don't use the calendar, let's say, that everybody else uses. So it ends up being our holidays move around the calendar.
They move around a little bit, you know.
And so I still remember when I was trying to make this watch the Hebrew Hammer on the first night of Hanukkah a thing, I remember watching it on Thanksgiving because Hanukkah came early. And it was just this weird confluence.
No, you see, you're wrong there. You're wrong there. Hanukkah doesn't come early. It always comes on the 25th of Kislev, you know, but...
Sometimes we get an extra month.
There you go.
Okay. but it was just this weird happenstance of watching the Hebrew Hammer after Thanksgiving dinner. And yeah, but that's my one of my little off the beaten path stories. And you know, growing up, we didn't have like a movie like that. And so I found this at the right part of my life that I could pick it up and run with it. And I'm excited that I have it.
Yeah. I mean, I gotta say, as a Jew, knowing how many Jews are in Hollywood, it's really, really strange that it took so long for there to be a movie about Hanukkah. You know, like nobody did anything about it. And it just doesn't make any sense. It was as if everyone just completely ignored the fact. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of the greatest Christmas songs are written by Jews, you know, but, you know, so I don't know, maybe it deniers.
Yeah, fair enough.
But that's fine. Okay, great. Now we're moving on to Wednesday. Wednesday segment is Hans Hump Day, where we get our top five Alan Rickman performances. Not Alan Rickman films, because some of the films are really bad, but he has a great performance in them. So once again, your top five, start with number five and work your way up.
So I have not seen more than 5 minutes of basically the first Harry Potter film. I will at some point watch them, but it's the reason that that's nowhere near my list is because I've never watched them. So I didn't feel like I know a lot of people put him up there, but I've never seen them. So this is not because I didn't like him in Harry Potter. It's because I've not seen him in Harry Potter.
Okay, but so you've read the books though. So you're really
no.
Even
no I know I missed I was too old when the Potter books became a thing, and I was reading other things at that point. For all I just kind of missed it. And I know there are people my age that went back and were, you know, read it and all that stuff. I at some point I do plan on watching all of the films to at least catch myself up. But yeah, just never. I missed it completely.
About 8 years ago, I had never read the books. I was very much against them. I didn't like the books. I saw all the movies and I enjoyed them, but I wasn't a fan of the books. And about 8 years ago, I decided, okay, you know what? I'm going to sit down and I'm going to read all the books. I couldn't put them down. I was so amazed at how rich the stories were. And then I rewatched the movies afterwards, and I was then disappointed in the movies. You know,
what
happens a lot.
Fair enough. I will watch the movies first, and then maybe I will pick. I mean, the books are in my house. Stephanie read all of them, but I've got so much else to read.
I understand.
But anyway.
I understand.
So – for Rickman, number five, Love Actually. I actually think it's because of that movie. I think that movie gets crapped on because it became a meme of itself, but like he's really good in that.
Yeah.
Number four, Galaxy Quest. Number three, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Number two, Die Hard. And number one, Dogma, which might be not only my favorite Rickman film, but might be my favorite casting of Rickman ever.
Wow.
Because he plays Metatron, which is just like, he plays a disenfranchised angel basically.
Yeah.
And he does it. I never met Alan Rickman. But all I know is that when he was in Dogma, it felt like he wasn't acting. And to me, that performance was absolutely brilliant.
Wow.
So for me, that's my favorite Rickman.
Okay, that's fair enough. Yeah. Thank you for that list. Let's move along real quickly to Thursday, back to another Off the Beaten Track story. So you have another holiday story to enthrall us with, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the moment I I've never been big on holidays, period. And it's not, I know people are going to be like, well, Jason, you're Jewish. I understand why you don't like Christmas. Like, I've also never really been that big a fan of New Year's or Thanksgiving or any of the others. And, you know, for that matter, I think the Jewish holidays aren't as fun as I would like them to be.
Because you know the quote about Jewish holidays. It's, you know, they tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat.
Let's eat. You know? Yeah. So when I bought my house, I started a regular Friendsgiving that has endured throughout the years. And it's probably the only holiday I'm actually excited for every year. And it's basically the Saturday after Thanksgiving. I invite any friends that are around and my parents and anybody else who's kind of in my circle over. And we basically just do Thanksgiving over again, but with invited guests, not just people you happen to be related to. And okay, it's always been probably it's a holiday I look forward to. And I know a lot, you know, people now do it's people do it on a more regular basis. But that's my thing now. That's the one holiday I really enjoy, considering I don't really celebrate anything. In fact, just as a little self-promotion, on episode 52 of my podcast, which was my 2-year anniversary, because, you know, a bi-weekly show, I had a friend of mine on to talk about celebrations and anniversaries on the sheer fact that he celebrates celebrations and anniversaries and I don't.
Mm-hmm. I remember that episode.
But yeah. So anyway, Friendsgiving, that's the one I like. Yeah.
Okay. That works. That's great. All right. So now we've reached Friday. So Friday's segment is Weekend Surprise. Now we've touched a little bit on this throughout the course of today's conversation. And I know what your answer is going to be, but I still, you know, still want you to have the opportunity to let yourself be heard. Okay, so one of the biggest controversies about Die Hard over the last 34 years is Die Hard a Christmas movie or not? So Jason, what do you think? Is it a Christmas movie or not? And make sure that you give us good reasonings for why you think it is or isn't.
Yes, it absolutely is a holiday movie, a Christmas movie. Mainly because this movie cannot happen at any other time of the year. This is a holiday party. Like, let's not forget, they are taking hostages at a holiday party that they know there will be because it's a holiday party. And everybody else is out of the building because they're staying late for a holiday party. Like, that's a very important plot point. This isn't just, it happens to be Christmas. No, it is. And that's, I think that the only reason people say it's not a holiday movie is because it's an action movie. But that doesn't. These are not binary states. It can be an action movie and a holiday movie. Case closed.
Okay.
I don't know.
No, that's fine. I completely understand. And people will once again have to come back tomorrow to hear my opinion as to whether it's a Christmas movie or not. You know.
I did bury the lead, right? Like, I talked about holiday movies as far as Diner, which also takes place during Christmas, yeah, and Iron Man 3, which takes place during Christmas. So to me,
but those are movies that can take place in other times also.
They do. Diner takes place over like a couple weeks, yeah, I think, but it's around the holidays, so that's an important piece of it.
Yeah.
So.
All right, great. So you have anything else you want to talk about with Die Hard? Or do you think you've talked enough about it?
No, I mean, I could probably talk about it for a long time.
Yeah. So can I. And I've been doing that.
I will just say
tomorrow I'll have to give everyone the tally of how many minutes I've talked about Die Hard.
As far as Die Hard goes, I think if you were to ask me in 1988, right, or even in the early 90s, like, what franchise, what action franchise would I want to continue? I don't know if I would have said Die Hard.
Well, you were five.
Well, in the early 90s, even. Like, I'm just saying, like, put me back there.
Little five-year-old Jason, what did you think about Die Hard? Oh, it should become a franchise.
I'm super excited that it came through because I was, you know, honestly, Die Hard, Live Free or Die Hard, yeah, it made my list, but it was also one of the only ones I really saw in theaters. Mm-hmm. And so that's a part of it. I think just like saying that your favorite Bond is also kind of related to the first one you see in theaters. I think as a franchise, it's good. And the book that it's based on has been on my reading list for a while. And eventually I will actually pick it up.
Nothing Lasts Forever is a great book. It's good. Again, yeah, I mean, they made a better movie out of it. But in the book, we get a lot of the emotions that you don't get in the movie. Okay. You know, we get all Bruce Willis's facial expressions and stuff like that, you know, which we see the pain that he's going through. But in the book, there is much more that the character is going through because the character is also older and he's there to be with his daughter, not with his wife. And his daughter's name is Stephanie. So who knows? Okay. Maybe that's a reason for you to read it. I don't know.
Oh, this was fun, man.
Yeah. It's been a lot of fun. So, Jason, why don't you tell people how they can find Agent Palmer?
Yeah, agentpalmer.com. And from there, you can contact me on, like, you know, Twitter, if it still happens to exist as we are recording this ahead of time, who knows? But I'm at Agent Palmer on almost anything you can think of. And I do also talk a lot on thepalmerfiles.com, which is a podcast where I just have interesting conversations with interesting people. And that's basically the entire premise of my entire podcasting career.
And that's a great premise. I've enjoyed one of the things I love about your podcast is the diversity. You just have people from so many different fields that are talking about so many different things, but the core of all of their conversations are connected. And that just always amazes me each time. You know, like, I hear who your guest is on the next episode, and I'm like, okay, how are they going to connect this to the main theme of your podcast? And it always goes there. And that's why it's great.
Yeah, I've never been accused of being brief.
Well, for people that have listened to us for 90 minutes... You know, I think I have the same syndrome as you do, but that's fine.
Yeah.
All right. And finding me is very simple. For just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, or you can go directly to my website, movierobminute.com. So once again, thank you very much, Jason. This has been a lot of fun. I love talking to you. You know, you're a fun person to talk to and a fun guest. You know, I don't know which one you're funner with, but, you know, either way, doesn't matter. I will be back again tomorrow for the final episode of this season, where we will reveal all the great information about, you know, what everyone's favorite Die Hard doppelganger movies were and what everyone's favorite Alan Rickman movies were. And also, obviously, how many of my guests think that this is a Christmas movie and how many do not. So you have to come back tomorrow to listen to all those different things on the very special, in a very special episode of Movie Rob Minute.
Yes.
which will come out on a Sunday, which usually also doesn't happen. But until then, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.